Lecture 9, Traits That Shape How You Think.
We talked previously about personality differences that are associated with basic traits, basic motives, and basic emotional tendencies. Where people stand on the big five, what people are generally motivated to do, and the emotions that they tend to experience. Now we're going to turn our attention to cognitive aspects of personality, characteristics that are related to people's styles of thinking and to some of people's fundamental beliefs. We don't all think exactly the same way, and we don't all think the same things. And these differences in cognition play an important role in making us who we are. I'm not talking here about differences in people's intelligence or in their ability to reason or in other mental abilities. Of course, differences in mental abilities are obviously important in understanding people, but psychologists draw a distinction between ability, that is, intelligence, skills, and aptitudes, and personality. And what we're going to be talking about is personality. Just so you know where we're headed in this lecture, we're going to focus on four cognitive characteristics that involve differences in the degree to which people seek information and try to understand things, make decisions and come to conclusions slowly versus quickly, recognize that their beliefs may be incorrect, and enjoy thinking and solving problems. Given that you're listening to this course, I'm going to hazard a guess that you're a reasonably curious person. You seem to be interested in learning about new things. So let's start by talking about the desire to seek information and to try to understand things, the trait of curiosity. At its core, curiosity reflects a motive to explore and to understand. How much do you like learning about new stuff? How generally curious are you? Like most personality characteristics, curiosity lies on a continuum. Some people are very low in curiosity. They don't seem to have much interest in learning about and understanding things. And some people are very high. Those people can seem absurdly fascinated by almost everything. They exude curiosity everywhere they go. And most of us lie somewhere in between. We're curious about some things, but not about others. And it matters where you fall on this continuum in terms of understanding your behavior and your life. Your level of curiosity not only relates to how you spend your time, after all, right now you're listening to this lecture rather than doing other things, but it also relates to the knowledge that you accumulate over time. Curious people expose themselves to a broader array of information, which can then influence their views of the world in ways that affect their lives. Curiosity also seems to promote memory. People remember things better that they approach with an air of curiosity. And people's level of curiosity is also somewhat related to how well they do in school and the kinds of jobs they prefer. Really curious people seem to possess two distinct characteristics. One is that they're motivated to seek knowledge and to have new experiences that they can learn from. And the other is a general openness to novelty and uncertainty. That is, people who are maximally curious are both motivated to find out about things and they're comfortable learning and having new experiences. Just being interested sometimes isn't enough because the motive to explore and to understand can be thwarted by a fear of novelty or uncertainty. We're sometimes curious about things that we're afraid to try. I might be curious to know what some exotic food tastes like, but not be willing to act on that curiosity. When you look at it in terms of these two distinct characteristics, people can differ in curiosity either because they differ in the degree to which they want to explore and understand, or because they differ in their openness to new things, or both. People who are highest in curiosity are those who are both highly motivated to find out about a lot of things and they're not afraid to jump in with both feet to exploring new experiences and ideas and places. And this explains why two of the personality traits that correlate most strongly with curiosity are openness and neuroticism. People who are generally more open to new experiences and ideas and ways of doing things are significantly more curious than people who are lower in openness. People who are high in openness are both more motivated to learn new things, and they're more open to the new things that they might learn. But on top of that, neuroticism is negatively related to curiosity. People who score higher in neuroticism tend to be less curious. Why? Because even if they're interested in something at an intellectual level, they can be deterred from acting on their curiosity by worries and concerns. After all, we have the old saying, curiosity killed the cat. And although most of us aren't going to be killed by too much curiosity, there are sometimes physical or social or psychological risks associated with seeking knowledge and experiences. Being really curious can lead you to uncover disturbing information, or to make a fool of yourself, or to even hurt yourself as you explore and try new things. And research also shows that people who are generally high in positive emotionality tend to be more curious. What we don't know is why. One possibility is that highly curious people live a more interesting and engaging life because they find interesting things wherever they go, so they're happier. Or maybe positive emotions may make people more open and receptive to exploring. Maybe both are true. We just don't know. In any case, the most curious people tend to score high in openness and positive emotionality, but low in neuroticism. Although we usually think of curiosity as a private, personal pursuit of knowledge and experiences, curiosity also has implications for people's social behavior. Research shows that people who are more curious have more satisfying conversations and social relationships with other people. There are probably a couple of things going on here. Curious people are generally more interested in other people and what they have to say. They're just more curious, which fosters better social interactions. On top of that, being curious gives people a larger repertoire of interesting things to talk about. They can contribute to a broader range of conversations because they have lots of little tidbits of information that they picked up along the way, and they find more topics interesting. Usually, when people talk about curiosity, they're talking about what's called epistemic curiosity, which focuses on gaining knowledge or understanding. But some researchers have also examined something called perceptual curiosity, which involves curiosity about sensory stimuli. People who are high in perceptual curiosity like to feel fabrics or taste new foods or examine a piece of artwork in depth or listen to new or unusual music or to sniff things to see what they smell like. They're not trying to learn new intellectual information, but they're curious about things' sensory qualities. Perceptual curiosity deals with curiosity about sensations and experiences. The tendency to be high in perceptual curiosity correlates with epistemic or intellectual curiosity, but they're distinct characteristics. You might be high in one kind of curiosity, but not in the other. I'm pretty high in epistemic curiosity, but not in perceptual curiosity. Another personality characteristic that's negatively related to curiosity, and that's interesting in its own right, involves the degree to which people tolerate ambiguity. How comfortable are you with uncertainty and ambiguity, with not being sure that you understand something or that you made the right decision? Some people tolerate ambiguity very well. They don't mind the complexity and uncertainty and shades of gray in life. But other people don't. They want to be certain about things, and ambiguity is distressing to them. People who dislike ambiguity and uncertainty want clear, concrete answers to questions, as opposed to qualified or uncertain answers. They want definitive information about everything, and they want it sooner rather than later. People's tolerance for ambiguity is related to the degree to which they want to reach conclusions and make decisions quickly. People who are high in tolerance for ambiguity don't mind not having answers or not making final decisions. And they may even prefer to let things remain undecided as long as possible before reaching closure. People who have a low tolerance for ambiguity, though, want answers immediately, so they make decisions quickly, sometimes before they have enough information. And of course, most of us are somewhere in the middle. We hold out for enough information to make good decisions, but we don't want to wait too long before reaching a resolution. This characteristic is sometimes called the need for cognitive closure, where cognitive closure refers to making a decision quickly and then sticking with it. How quickly do you want to close the issue and reach a decision about what to believe or what to do? Having a high need for cognitive closure involves both an urgency to make decisions quickly and a reluctance to reconsider decisions that you've already made. For them, it's better to decide and close the issue once and for all rather than wait in a state of uncertainty. To see where you stand on need for cognitive closure, consider how much you agree with each of these statements. I dislike questions that can be answered in many ways. When I am confronted with a problem, I'm impatient to reach a solution very quickly. Do you agree? I don't like to go into a situation without knowing what to expect. I enjoy having a clear and structured way of living. I don't usually consult many different opinions before forming my own view. If you agreed with most of these statements, you probably lean toward being high in need for cognitive closure. Of course, most people prefer certainty over uncertainty. Most of us prefer clarity over ambiguity. The question is, how bothered are you by uncertainty and ambiguity? A good deal of research has examined how people who are low versus high in the need for cognitive closure differ. When they're trying to make a decision, people who have a high need for closure generate fewer ideas and options before they finally decide. Because they want to decide as quickly as possible, they make decisions based on a minimum amount of information. People who are low in need for closure don't mind dragging the process out by getting as many options and as much information as they can. So, imagine shopping for a new television set. People higher in need for closure will likely make the decision more quickly and without exploring as many options as people low in need for closure. Now, neither approach is better all the time. People high in need for closure make decisions more efficiently, but they may not consider all relevant information. On the other hand, those who are low in need for closure consider more options, but they take longer. In the same way, people high in need for closure seek less information about other people before they form an impression about what the other person is like. The longer I wait to draw conclusions about you when we meet, the more ambiguity I have to deal with. People high in need for closure are also more likely to draw conclusions about people based on stereotypes. Although stereotypes can certainly create problems, they're often very useful. We can't always learn a great deal of information about a person when we first meet them. But if we know that the person is a college professor, or a homeless person, or a military officer, or a computer geek, we can rely on stereotypes for starters. We might be wrong about the person, but stereotypes allow us to draw conclusions quickly. which is why people who are high in need for closure use them more. If I stereotype you, I think I know what you're like. Need for cognitive closure also relates to how people seek information about other people. Imagine that you've just met someone for the first time, and you're trying to get to know them. What kind of information do you want to know? What kinds of questions would you ask? Research shows that people who don't like ambiguity and want closure ask about more concrete and specific things. They want information that will help them learn about this person with as little ambiguity as possible. People who are low in need for closure tend to ask more abstract questions, things that provide less definitive information about the other person. Many decisions in life are made in groups, and people who are low versus high in need for cognitive closure differ in how they want those group discussions to go, and they can drive each other nuts. Group members who are high in need for cognitive closure want the group to reach decisions as quickly as possible. But those who are low in need for closure are happy to talk things out in great detail. And they might not be bothered if the meeting ends without the group making a decision. So members high in need for closure find it maddening that the discussion is dragged on. And those low in need for closure may be frustrated at feeling rushed. And group members who are high in need for closure not only want the group to reach a decision quickly, but they want there to be consensus. If we all agree on a decision, I can feel pretty confident that it's the right decision, and I feel a sense of closure. But if group members disagree, and we end up voting 6-5 to do something, I'm left with a great deal of uncertainty and not much sense of closure about our decision. And people high in need for closure don't like that. They even prefer different kinds of group leaders. Members with a need for closure prefer directive and even autocratic leaders, leaders who make the decisions themselves and then tell the group what to do. Whereas members low in need for closure prefer democratic leaders who let the group talk about things and then decide. The interesting thing is that even though people who are high in need for closure make their decisions and choices more quickly, and they make them on the basis of less information than people who are low in need for closure, people high in need for closure are more confident that their conclusions and decisions are correct. Now, logically, that doesn't make much sense. Having less information and thinking less deeply about something should make you less confident. Why would people who are high in need for closure tend to feel more confident despite the fact that they haven't spent as much time thinking about things? Well, first, people who consider issues in less detail may feel more confident because they've exposed themselves to less contrary information. In many cases, the more information you consider, the more cloudy and uncertain the picture becomes. So considering less information may make you feel more confident that you're right. In addition, people who dislike ambiguity may talk themselves into feeling more confident. So in this case, building up one's confidence is a psychological strategy that increases certainty and allows closure on a decision. However people make decisions, and whatever conclusions they reach, we all know certain people who seem to think that they are always right. What's that all about? Interest in belief certainty and closed-mindedness started with research on the authoritarian personality in the 1940s. We'll talk about the authoritarian personality in another lecture. But one aspect of being authoritarian is an unshakable conviction that your beliefs are correct. But authoritarianism involves a particular set of beliefs, and people can be unjustifiably certain about all kinds of things. So researchers began to study traits that involve excessive certainty more generally. I've personally been involved in a large research project on the topic of intellectual humility, which involves the degree to which people recognize that what they believe might be wrong. Of course, people don't usually think that their beliefs are wrong. It would be strange to say, yes, I believe X, but I know that X isn't true. But how open are you to the possibility that you might be wrong? People who are high in intellectual humility are more willing to accept the possibility that their beliefs and their attitudes might be incorrect or unfounded. People low in intellectual humility are more certain that their beliefs and attitudes are correct. People who are higher in intellectual humility display characteristics that involve being open and flexible in their thoughts. For example, people high in intellectual humility score higher on the trait of openness, and they're lower in need for cognitive closure. They tolerate ambiguity better. Intellectually humble people also tend to be more curious, and they like to think more than people who are low in intellectual humility. They also tend to score lower in self-righteousness. Interestingly, intellectual humility is not associated with either religiosity or political affiliation. I know that there's a stereotype that religious people and political conservatives are more entrenched in their views and more resistant to change, which might suggest that they would be lower in intellectual humility. But research shows that religious people and conservatives are no more intellectually arrogant on average than atheists and liberals are. I published a study a few years ago that looked at the degree to which people with liberal versus conservative political beliefs thought that their views were superior. We asked a large sample of adults about their attitudes on a number of controversial political issues, such as immigration, capital punishment, and taxation. And we also had them rate the degree to which they thought their attitudes were superior to other possible views. Overall, people who had liberal and conservative attitudes didn't differ in their belief superiority. Interestingly, though, each side was more arrogant about a few particular beliefs than the other side was. People with liberal views were more certain than conservatives that their beliefs about government aid for the needy, the use of torture on terrorists, and basing laws on religion were superior. But when it came to attitudes toward voter identification laws, taxes, and affirmative action, people with conservative views were more certain that their beliefs were superior. No matter what your beliefs are, you can hold those beliefs in an intellectually humble fashion that allows the possibility that you might be wrong, or in an intellectually arrogant fashion that says there's little or no possibility that your beliefs are incorrect. People who are high in intellectual humility are also more sensitive to the quality of the evidence on which their beliefs are based than intellectually arrogant people are. Because they're open to the possibility they might be wrong, people who are high in intellectual humility pay greater attention to the evidence for and against their beliefs. But people who don't often entertain the possibility that their beliefs are incorrect, those low in intellectual humility, pay less attention to the evidence. Why analyze evidence and arguments deeply if you're convinced you're 100% correct? Intellectual humility also matters in how we deal with other people. The more intellectually humble people are, the less they judge other people by what they believe. Sometimes it's hard to like and accept people who believe something that's contrary to our own views. But people who are higher in intellectual humility have an easier time separating their judgments of people from their judgments of those people's beliefs. People higher in intellectual humility are also more tolerant of people who change their minds. One study asked research participants to evaluate a political candidate who changed his position on an issue. Participants who were lower in intellectual humility were more likely to think that the candidate was flip-flopping just to get elected. And maybe he was. But participants who were higher in intellectual humility were more open to the possibility that the candidate had actually changed his view. After all, intellectually humble people know that they would change their own mind if they had new evidence that their old view was wrong. So they accept the possibility that other people, even politicians, might change their minds as well. Some people go beyond simply believing that they are right to thinking that they have an obligation to try to correct other people's ignorant beliefs. And there's a scale that measures this characteristic, which researchers call social vigilantism. It has items on the scale, such as, I feel as if it's my duty to enlighten other people. I feel that my ideas should be used to educate others. There are a lot of ignorant people in society. I try to get people to listen to me because what I have to say makes a lot of sense. And if everyone saw things the way that I do, the world would be a better place. Now, of course, many of us feel obligated to correct other people's beliefs in certain domains. In fact, it's part of many people's professions. Teachers and physicians and scientists and activists spend a lot of time trying to change people's minds. Social vigilantism goes beyond reasonable efforts to educate people in a particular domain to a broad tendency to let all of the stupid people out there know that they're wrong and that you're right. So it's much more than this just simply low intellectual humility. The final cognitive trait that I want to mention is need for cognition, which refers to the degree to which people enjoy thinking. How much do you like to think? Some people derive a great deal of intrinsic enjoyment from thinking and analyzing and pondering just for its own sake. And other people don't like thinking. They'll think when they need to, but just thinking about things doesn't sound like their idea of fun. So what difference does it make how much a person likes to think? Well, most importantly, people who are higher in need for cognition consider more information and think about it more deeply when they have to make a decision. Whereas people who are lower in need for cognition think less and often rely on cognitive shortcuts. And because they think more deeply, people who are high in need for cognition remember more details about things they read. For example, when you're shopping for something, particularly a big ticket item like a new television or a refrigerator or a car, how fully do you examine and think about the features of all of the various brands? Or how carefully do you examine the credentials of the candidates before voting in a local election? People who are high in need for cognition seek more information before they make decisions. And because they think more deeply about things, people high in need for cognition are more affected by the quality of arguments. Imagine a research study in which you receive either strong arguments or weak arguments to persuade you to make a decision, such as to believe something or to buy a particular product. People who are higher in need for cognition are more affected by whether the arguments are weak or strong than people low in need for cognition. Because people high in need for cognition think about the evidence more deeply, they recognize good and bad arguments more easily than people low in need for cognition do. Finally, people higher in need for cognition enjoy mental tasks and games that involve thinking more than those who are low in need for cognition. And they watch less television, presumably because TV usually doesn't require as much thinking as other things they could be doing. We've never collected data to check this, but I suspect that people who listen to courses from the teaching company score relatively high in need for cognition. Because people who are low and high in need for cognition differ in how they process information, advertisers need to consider consumers' need for cognition as they design their ads. For example, People who are high need for cognition prefer advertisements that present comparative information about two products and allow them to decide which brand is best, rather than ads that tell them about only one brand. They want to think about it. People who are high in need for cognition also spend more time looking at an ad than people low in need for cognition, and they tend to remember the details better. We normally think of thinking and decision-making as being mainly cognitive processes. So they're naturally affected by people's intellectual abilities, how smart they are and how well they reason, for example. But as we have seen in this lecture, how people think and consider information is also affected by personality tendencies that have little to do with how smart people are or how well they think. So being motivated by curiosity or wanting cognitive closure or believing that your beliefs are always right, or just liking to think, all play a role in how you think, process information, make decisions, and interact with other people.